Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Fiction, science fiction, horror, fantasy, crime, LGBT, thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on KCBQ 106.5 FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
Hello, welcome back to the House of Mystery on KKNW 1150 AM Seattle. I'm your host, Al Warren.
And I'm Kev Thompson.
Okay. Now, today we're talking about another A&E series that we've come across that's set to air here. It's The Menendez Murders, Eric Tells All. And who's sitting in with us is the executive producer and director of the series, Nancy Saslow. So thanks for being here, Nancy.
You bet.
So, now Nancy, so when does this series start to air here? It's November 30th, and it's going to be on at 10 p.m.
Yeah.
And so...
Right, on A&E.
A&E. What brought you into the series? Like, how did you start working in the Menendez Murders?
Well, several years ago, we were, it actually started with Scott Peterson. I know that sounds odd, but our offices were at the time down the road from San Quentin Prison. And Scott Peterson had just been brought to San Quentin. And part of the coverage was that when he arrived at San Quentin, he had something like 3,000 letters from all kinds of women, from marriage proposals, and we thought, gosh, who are these women? So we started to put together an idea to search for women who married men inside with virtually no hope of getting out, and who are these women and why did they do it? And during the course of that, Tammy Menendez, who Eric Menendez had married in prison in 1999, had been promoting a book she had written called They Said We'd Never Make It. And we sort of stopped with Tammy because she had such an interesting story, and it was unlike sort of what you would assume. And so we spoke for a long time and convinced her to work with us, and we produced a documentary on Tammy for A&E Indie Films, which also aired on A&E, and thus began a relationship of sorts with the family. And during the course of that, I had spoken with Eric, of course. And in this past couple of years, when it had been 20 years last year since the final verdict in 1996, and there were all sorts of Menendez programs planned, Most prominent was the scripted version that Dick Wolf was doing for NBC. And we said, you know, this is the time to really do the entire story and the full story. And because we knew that access was the key to differentiating our program, we approached Tammy and Eric, and they said yes.
That's amazing. So when you actually got to talk to Eric, were you surprised by how he was, who he was, compared to what you thought he was?
Or his demeanor?
Well, I'll tell you, I had been surprised the first time that I had spoken with him. I think people, when something has been in the news as this had at the time, between 1989 and 1996, and, you know, even subsequently, we tend to have snapshots in our minds of, you know, this 18 and 23-year-old and 26-year-old kid, essentially. And the person that I talked with over a period of months for this program is a 47-year-old man. And you begin to hear that. So I would say the perspective of someone who has been in prison longer than he's been out, someone that you thought you knew because of all of the media coverage, but really didn't because he's never had an opportunity, and I should say he's probably had the opportunity, but he's never taken the opportunity to tell his story unfettered by a courtroom. So I can tell you that the series of interviews that we did over a period of months, and the reason it took that long is that, you know, prisoners don't have, you know, great access to the phone. So these were done basically in 12-minute segments, and you folks who do interviews all the time can understand that if you are talking to somebody who's basically sharing his 47 years with you, that 12 minutes at a time can be a daunting task. But I have to give him credit because he was ready to tell his story unfettered by a courtroom. He was ready to give specific details and relive basically his childhood, the time leading up to the murders, and the time afterwards. And I found him to be extraordinary, really, in the way in which he expressed himself, but also in the authenticity that he brought to all of it. And it was stunning to hear him express himself and to hear him reflect as a 47-year-old man and not this 18-year-old kid, you know, in sweaters, quite frankly, that we remember from the first trial.
Now, Nancy, kudos to you, because I work in the corrections field, and I know how difficult it is for an inmate just to get to the phone, let alone convey all of his thoughts at 12 to 15 minutes at a time. So kudos to you for that. But at any point during the interviews, did you feel like what he was telling you was polished and thought out just to, I don't know, assuage any guilt on his part?
Well, that's the thing. I think that he, you know, I don't think this wasn't convincing a jury. It knows, and I've been in this business a pretty long time and grew up in it as a journalist. And so I didn't, as we like to say, just sort of fall off the back of the turnip truck. I think I know when I'm hearing something that's true. And I not only heard specifics that I had never heard in all of the research, but the sense of consistency and authenticity is blinding at times. No, I didn't feel like he had spent the last 27 years in prison coming up with a story or polishing one. I felt that there were times, for example, that he would share something extremely difficult and then really have to go away for a few days. Because, you know, as you know, having worked in the prison system, generally speaking, in order to live day to day, you don't sit around thinking about your crime. You don't sit around dwelling on it. But there were a couple of things that were remarkable about Eric. The first is how consistent, how heartfelt, how challenging it was for him to share these stories. And the second thing is he has more than regret. He has remorse. I'm not sure that this is somebody who can ever forgive himself for what he's done. He acknowledges it. This is not a this is not an apology tour, as it's usually called now in America when people mm-hmm. do this sort of thing.
Yes.
This is an opportunity that he finally took to tell, not even his side, to tell what he lived and to tell where he is right now. And it's truly an extraordinary piece of television, and I'm not saying that to pat us on the back. I'm saying when you bear witness to somebody who essentially comes clean, it's quite something.
Did it change your opinion of him?
It did. I didn't go from, gosh, he didn't, you know, this is not a whodunit. We all know that they did the killings. But it reinforced some things that after the first time I had spoken with him that I really came to believe. And that is that he was terribly abused as a child. And I don't state this as fact. I'm saying that in the course of talking with him and many other experts, it is something that I believe. But I think one of the things that's important about this program is that at no time do we say that the abuse and the fear and all of the things that he had were justification for killing his parents. There is no justification for killing his parents. And the important thing that I think viewers will understand is that Eric Menendez doesn't believe there's justification, and he believes he should have been punished. But I think this program takes us to a place because of the way in which Eric spoke with us and because of all the people that we got to talk with us as they shared with us their experiences. I think that this takes us to a place about the sentencing and whether at the time, because of a confluence of things, not the least of which involved what was going on in the Los Angeles District Attorney's Office in terms of a series of high-profile losses, and 9 days before the second Menendez trial, having had the O.J. verdict, a judge who reversed himself inexplicably in the second trial, and he had presided over the first. An American conscience about child sexual abuse that really wasn't as developed as it is now. We understand things now that we didn't 21 years ago. So I think what this series does is, number one, it gives us a window to how brothers could get to a point where they committed this heinous act. And number two, I think it makes us perhaps take a second look at the sentencing. Not at the verdicts, but at the sentencing.
Well, Nancy, these murders happened in 1989, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
And, okay, some of our listening audience is a little bit younger. They may not remember the Menendez murders. Can you give us a very brief recap of what happened and why we're here today?
Yes, well, on August 20th, 1989, in Beverly Hills, California, a rather wealthy couple, Jose Menendez and Kitty Menendez, were found by their sons in their home, brutally murdered. And there was no connection to anything at the time on why this would happen. I mean, you can imagine Beverly Hills, California, I think, has maybe two murders a year. This kind of thing doesn't happen. And he was an entertainment executive, so the story really went ballistic. And subsequently in the investigation, and I would suggest, you know, watching the series to see how it all ties together, but the investigation led eventually to a confession by Eric to his psychologist, and subsequently they were arrested, and there still wasn't a good explanation for why they did it until the trial, when Leslie Abramson, who was an unbelievable criminal defense attorney, said that they had been molested and they acted out of fear. They had not only been molested as young children, Lyle first and then Eric from age 6 to 18, but they had been told repeatedly by their parents that if they ever told, they would be killed. And so their story was that they killed out of fear.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah.
But in 1989, this was front page news. This was front page news that went away for a while. And, you know, people who are younger don't remember. But the Menendez trial was at the time the trial of the century. And it basically launched a national audience for a network called Court TV. It was the first time that we saw lawyers talking to media on the steps. It was O.J. before O.J. So if you're young enough where you don't remember, this was a huge deal. This was the first time, wasn't the first time for cameras in the courtroom, but it was the first time that it was around something that was so sensational, and the media went crazy. It basically created the industry of, you know, TV lawyers who we see now all the time, but all of the pundits that you see that talk about these trials that come up, whether it's, you know, O.J. or Michael Jackson or Casey Anthony, mm-hmm. And onward, that really came out of the Menendez trial. And it was also, I think, the first time that we got a look at a wealthy family's, if you will, dirty laundry, in that, you know, no one was talking about wealth associated with child sexual abuse. And I think that sort of sensational element gave rise to a national audience. There's a story that we were not able to confirm, but we were told that President Clinton at the time was so interested and captivated by the trial that he would sort of sneak away in the White House to an anteroom and watch it. Now, you know, that wasn't just because of the sensationalism. I mean, you have to remember President Clinton was a lawyer, but it really captured America like nothing else had captured it before.
Yeah, as I remember it too back then, and I'm old enough, it seemed like there was two audiences. A lot of people didn't believe in their claims of sexual abuse and thought they were just doing it to get the money. And then there's people that believed the sexual claim. And that's sort of what I was hinting at. So how did you feel back in 89 about the case? And has it changed now?
Honestly, I don't remember feeling passionately one way or the other, which is why this journey for us has been fascinating. It's been truly interesting because, you know, I feel as if I've sort of come to it anew. I was working at the time as a producer in at a CBS station in San Francisco, and so I didn't really... I don't really remember all of those things about it, but I can tell you this, you're absolutely right. The national narrative that people walked away with was that these were two Beverly Hills rich kids who killed their parents for money. And there was another part of the audience that said, oh my gosh, these kids were terrorized. A lot of that was along gender lines. A reporter, Jody Baskerville from KCBS in Los Angeles, told me that most of the women reporters really believed them and felt for the guys. And most of the camera people who were men at the time, said absolutely not true. And interestingly enough, the hung jury split that way as well.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. Now, you only got to talk to Eric. Did you ever talk to his brother, or is it just Eric completely?
It's just Eric. And, you know, at a certain point, that was more or less a choice. You know, both of them absolutely did the crime. But our assertion is that the Menendez story really is very much Eric's story. And you have to understand, these are not young men who shared anything with each other because they were under threat. It was Eric telling his brother the week before, actually just a few days before the killings, that created an environment where they felt that this was, that their killing was imminent. It was sort of a kill or be killed. And ultimately, it was Eric who confessed to his therapist that got them there. The bottom line, I was, you know, saying that we knew I had access to Eric, and part of it, as you guys know, is access. And when we continue to think about it, you know, no one has ever approached this as Eric's story. But essentially, it is. And again, that is not to dismiss Lyle's part in it, or the fact that he, too, paid the price for those actions, or any of that. It's not a diss, if you will. But we find Eric's ability to express himself extraordinary, and the willingness to do that equally so. And essentially, there were points at which he, had he not done what he did, in essence, or had what happened to him not happened to him, that this would not be something that we'd be talking to you about today. So I think that Eric's is an incredibly compelling story, and when you're doing that over a period of time with audiences, I think that he's the one to take the journey with.
There's a lot of shows that have been on, like Lifetime, and a lot of different movies and stuff about it. They all sort of tell a different narrative. Do you feel like what you get from Eric is you believe it's really the true story?
I do believe it's his truth. I don't know that any of us can come in and say the truth. But right. Here's what I think is important, is that Eric is certainly our main character. But this narrative over 5 hours is expressed through an awful lot of people and has many different perspectives. That was critical, and Eric and his wife Tammy certainly understood that. So Eric's not the only voice, far from it. We talked probably with more than 30 people. We had, I think, some 30 interviews. And those include family members. Those include, of course, his wife, Tammy. But it also includes people like Carol Nahara, who was the second chair in the second trial, prosecutor. It includes Gil Garcetti, former Los Angeles district attorney. It includes Chris Darden, best known for the OJ trial, but somebody who was part of the Los Angeles District Attorney's Office for many, many years and gave us really an up-close view as to what was going on in the DA's office. So we pursued this story far beyond Eric Menendez's tale because it was critical for us to do that, to explore beyond what Eric said, the true meaning of all of what happened. And, you know, this is not just a story about a killing. This is a story about child sexual abuse. This is a story about the possibility of judicial overreach. This is a story about the Los Angeles District Attorney's Office. This is a story about media coverage. it's about a lot of things. It's not just a tale from the perspective of one person. One of our consultants, for example, was Seattle's own Ann Bremner, who is...
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A legal pundit, well known for many, for commenting on many trials, and who was part of the Amanda Knox case. So Anne not only is part of this as a legal analyst, but she was also a consultant to the project. So we didn't just start and end, if you will, with Eric Menendez. We pursued this as journalists to get a full picture. What's different about this is that you do have Eric Menendez's perspective and storytelling as you never have before, but we certainly didn't stop there. That wouldn't have served the piece well, and that wouldn't have served the audience.
Now, Nancy, I would be remiss if I didn't ask this. I mean, I understand that as the story is right now, we've got two young victims of sexual abuse by their parents, which eventually led them to kill because they felt at the time that either we killed them or they're eventually going to kill us. Now, back in 1989, I was still in the military, and I remember hearing about this story and thinking, well, that's just a couple of spoiled brats that killed their parents. You know, who knows why? And I went on with my life. As I began to become more familiar with the Menendez brothers, my opinion of that didn't really change much, even though the allegations of sexual abuse came out. Mm-hmm. Now, here we are. We're making a series about this movie. I'm on the fence here. I'm willing to understand that these boys killed because of maybe repressed anger from the sexual abuse or they felt threatened. But, and this is the killer, this is the deal breaker for me. After the killings occurred, they go on this extravagant spending spree. What is that about? You know, did you kill them for the money, or did you kill them because of the sexual abuse? I mean, you're out buying Rolexes and Porsches. You're out spending money like it's going out of style. Psychologically, I'm willing to believe that maybe you felt that was owed to you. But, you know, do you see where I'm going, Nancy?
I do, and you are not alone. And that's one of the inspirations for doing the series, because I would have been remiss had I not asked Eric that. And we would have been remiss not to include that part of what the story was. And what we came to find out, and, you know, I would suggest you watch the series, because as it unfolds, that is included. Now, you may go away thinking the same thing, but I don't think so, because the spending, which was sort of a centerpiece in the first trial,
mm-hmm.
really became
Absolutely.
Less of one in the second trial. These, I think you will walk away believing that there's no way they committed this brutal act for money. It's just, when you hear the people who weigh in on it talk about it, it almost becomes ridiculous. But, it's a good point that there was a spending spree. It was Lyle. Mm-hmm. It was an error. Lyle, very much like his mother, used to, when he would be depressed or when he would be upset, just like his mom, they would shop. That's what they did. Eric, not so much, not very much attached to things. But the bottom line is that this notion that they killed their parents for money, these two kids never wanted for anything in terms
true.
Of...
That's true.
They never wanted for anything. They didn't have to kill their parents for money. They had money. So I'm not suggesting that this was justified, and I'm not suggesting that you don't have a point that was shared by an awful lot of people. I'm suggesting that when they went down that road, you ended up with two hung juries the first go-round. And the reason was that story didn't fly. You know, it sounds like shameless self-promotion, but watch the show, because those things are addressed. We didn't shy away from anything, and I think you will see, look, we're not in the tank, if you will, for Eric Menendez. That's not why A&E supported this. This is an opportunity not to give these men a pass, but this is an opportunity to be open to what happened
mm-hmm.
from a variety of points of view, and to make your own decision as to whether justice was done.
One thing I can say, one thing that strikes me is in a lot of the shows I've seen before on the case, they've suggested that Lyle sexually assaulted Eric. Did you guys cover that?
Uh-oh.
Yes, that is true. Eric's first abuser was his brother. The perspective on that, and again, this is not a show about excuses, but the perspective on that is that Lyle was modeling his father's behavior toward him.
Right.
That's what I mean by understanding. Lyle talked about that during the trial. I mean, this is not a revelation that we've never heard before, but I think a lot of people forget that this started very, very early, and Lyle basically was mimicking what his father had been doing to him.
Yeah. No, and I agree with that.
It's very sad. It's all very tragic, and you know, again, I take the point that, well, it was so, you know, we also addressed, was this convenient, because it never came out until the lawyers got involved. And, you know, we certainly represent that point of view. But the depth, the specificity, and again, the authenticity with which this story is told, honestly, You just can't make that up.
No. No, I sort of believe in it, but I just wonder how Eric could get beyond that. Like, a lot of times when we're dealing with true crime and sexual abuse has been going on, like in this sort of situation with girls or boys, how did he separate Lyle from his father? Because they're both doing the same thing to him. Do you know what I'm saying? So that's just sort of the angle.
He was six. And when you're the younger brother, when the focus is on your older brother, and you're just trying to get attention and get love, and you have no idea what's going on. You just know, for example, that your dad has these special moments with you and is paying attention to you. You have no idea that this is not normal because Jose normalized these actions. You know, you don't know that there's anything wrong with this. And it's not until a few years later, and if it's just you and your brother and you never talk about this, and you certainly don't talk about it because your father and your mother have told you never to talk about the family, outside of the family, you don't know this is not normal until years later. And according to Eric, as the sexual abuse increased over the years in terms of what his father did, it appeared that it wasn't the act of love that he was initially convinced at a very young age, that it appeared to be, at least initially. And so that wraps up into fear, that wraps up in, and when you can't tell, I mean, generally speaking, the discussion, and we have an expert in PTSD, and we have experts in child abuse, and kids don't tell. Kids don't tell when it's not safe, and when the people in your life who are supposed to help you think that you're safe make it unsafe, you don't know what to do, and you don't know how to read that. And if you're not talking to anybody else, you don't know that it's not normal.
Yeah.
His father or his brother, you know, I don't think he did. I think he knows and understands that his brother was his first abuser, but I think, and it's interesting, the reflection of a 47-year-old man on what happened does not, you know, I don't think he has feelings of anger against his brother because he knew his brother was just modeling his dad.
No. Now, Nancy, how do you answer the people, though, that say, listen, that excuse is old. You know, so many people blame their murders. Well, I was molested. You know, how do you answer that in this case?
Well, you're talking about the abuse excuse, which is one of the phrases that came out during the trial. Alan Dershowitz, the famous lawyer, came up with it. And all I can say to you is this, that in the conversations that I had, not only with Eric, but with the family and with abuse experts and with psychiatrists and with the depth of the interview list, if you will, there's just, I can tell you in this case, there's just no way that they made it up. There are too many consistencies. There are too many patterns that are like neon signs to what happened in this family. And I don't think, again, I think that it's very difficult to believe if we came from, I mean, I think we all come from dysfunctional families, but one of the things we as a team learned as we were in production on this is, gosh, maybe we came from dysfunctional families, but it wasn't this. And when we began to understand the horror and the true shame that and that these kids who are abused feel, I think it's important to acknowledge that and to also acknowledge that it's not a justification for killing your parents. And so I don't understand what I understand that people find it difficult to believe because those acts are difficult to believe anyway. And when they're assigned to parents, you know, those of us who are parents say, I can't imagine ever doing this to my kid. But we know it's real, and we know it happens. And, you know, I can't imagine why two young men, even to save themselves, would get on the stand and say what they said in order to justify, if you will, killing their parents. I can't imagine a scenario, honestly, where that makes any sense. Not after I've talked with Eric, but especially not after I've talked with experts, with people who know a lot more about this than I do.
It appears to be, in today's society, that wealth creates distance inside families. So, you know, you've got the Menendez brothers who need nurturing. You know, they need father figure. They need mother figure. You've got the father that's out creating his millions. And oftentimes you've got the mother that's out, you know, doing her social activities. And you've got these brothers that are basically kind of raising themselves. And in some instances, they have a nanny that's possibly raising them. So that creates an emotional distance between the children and the parents. Now, you've added into the equation the possibility of sexual abuse, which was talked about in the trial. So, you know, that's, you know, creates animosity between the children and the parents. Do you think, though, that the wealth and that distance actually made it easier for those brothers to kill their parents? Maybe not seeing them as parents so much as, you know, enemies or abusers or somebody that I need to kill.
I don't, and I don't for a number of reasons. First of all, I don't think wealth created distance in the family. And that may seem very odd to say because we're also saying that it was an abusive household. But I don't believe that it was about money. I don't think that this family was distant from one another at all. You had two young men, for example, who played tennis. I mean, they were like show horses for their father, and their father was all over them in terms of their tennis games. And in fact, Lyle Menendez was so good that his former tennis coach said that, you know, given a little bit of time, he would have been top 20 in the world. So this was not a family. I mean, his father was at every match. His mother, I mean, you know, he was a sports dad, and he was really tough with them by all accounts. And, you know, they went through a ton of coaches because of that, and it may have been dysfunctional, but it certainly was not distant. I mean, if anything, it was a very close family in that, you know, they didn't have a lot of social gatherings. You know, Jose was not at all into the whole Hollywood thing. She was not very much a socialite. She was, by all accounts, depressed, suicidal.
Wow.
And so I'm talking about mental health issues. We're not talking about money. Where I do think money came in was that I do believe, to a certain extent, that money, that the fact that they came from money gave them a disadvantage, in terms of the eyes of the jury and the eyes of the police and the eyes of a lot of the audience, a lot of viewers, because, you know, the perception is these kids had everything and they just threw it away because of money. So I think the wealth ended up hurting them from an external standpoint, but that I don't think at all it was a factor within the family. And I don't think it was money that that brought these boys to a point where they killed their parents.
Do the boys still have a relationship at all?
With each other?
Yeah.
Yeah. Letters.
Are they allowed to visit at all?
No. They've not talked to one another in now 22 years.
Oh, my gosh.
They can't. The Department of Corrections has laws and rules about that, so they have no direct contact. But, you know, occasional letters and those sorts of things. And family members who talk with each other respectively are able to, you know, kind of update them.
Yeah.
Separately.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now I think this is a fair question. And I'm speaking as an authority in the corrections field. Nancy, have you ever thought about using your influence maybe to ask the Department of Corrections to allow a contact visit between the brothers?
Are you familiar with the California Departments of Corrections?
I am. They allow Manson to get married, so...
Yeah. But it's actually against the law in California to have a one-on-one. You know, you can't request a one-on-one media film visit. You know, I've gone and sat down and visited with Eric, and I can do that as a private citizen. But I can't bring camera crew in and sit down. I can. You've seen all those shows that I believe are on another network, the lockup shows. And those interviews are not prearranged. They're random. So if you play that forward, I could show up with my camera crew and get into any prison that I want. And if Eric Menendez or Lyle Menendez happened by, I could talk to them. But the chances of that happening are slim and none. So... you don't even try, and there are folks that have, you know, lied to get in. There are folks, you know, in the media and in the press that have attempted to do those sorts of things. But, you know, in this case, the written press has an advantage in that they can go and they can, I think, get permission to get a pencil and a paper, if you can believe it, and take notes on an interview. But that's about it. And the reason for that has to do with sensitivity toward victims and families. And I understand that. I respect that. I my personal opinion is that I think a little transparency would go a long way in the system. But, you know, we make the request, and then we accept the answer.
No, and I completely understand that. But I would like to just kind of see a little bit of a good ending, you know, to this series, you know, where... you know, we can go away from the reenactments, and this is reality right here. You know, this is the brothers meeting for the first time in 22 years. And, you know, and I'm speaking as a brother that doesn't get to see his brother very often at all. That would just, I don't know, maybe I'm just being sappy here.
Yeah.
But it would just be kind of really cool, you know, to end this series with that.
That would have been great, but not going to happen. And perhaps the best thing that the series do is open some eyes in terms of the sentencing, to look at laws which have changed, and to see if there is an opportunity for another trial. There is a possibility for appeal. And, you know, again, our job was not to campaign, and our job was not to influence a potential jury pool. Our job was to go in and get the story from Eric's perspective as much as we possibly could, because it's a story that we've never heard before, with this detail, with this specificity, with this depth. Also to surround it with other people who experience this Menendez phenomenon, if I can call it that, and to shed some light. I mean, that's why we got into this business. You want to talk zappy, that's me. You get into the business as a journalist to shine a light. And this, we believe, shines a light on a lot of things. It shines a light on incarceration. It shines a light on sentencing, on child sexual abuse and the impact and what we know now that we didn't know then. I think it's bigger than the Menendez trial. And what I hope that people walk away with is not only the sense of Eric's story, but the sense of what happened, and to look forward to maybe that there is a hope at least to get a second look.
Wow. Well, that's amazing, and we look forward to seeing the series. Now, it's going to be showing on Thursday, November 30th at 10 p.m. Eastern Pacific on A&E. And we look forward to it. The Menendez Murders, Eric Tells All. Again, it's been a very, very good show. Thank you for being on the show. We've had Nancy Saslow.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.